Friends, a very good evening, and welcome to Westminster Abbey, and particularly to the Lady Chapel. My name is Jamie Hawkey. I'm canon theologian here, and I chair the Westminster Abbey Institute. The Institute was founded 10 years ago, a decade ago, to nurture and revitalise moral and spiritual values in public life and public service. It works with institutions around Parliament Square and beyond to provoke discussion, nurture reflection, and to inspire the noble vocation to public service. Tonight's dialogue is part of our autumn season, exploring the theme of dignity, examining what dignity means, how it can be enabled, and especially in some of the hardest of times. In the opening lecture of our series, Bishop Graham Tomlin drew on the theological notion of an alien dignity bestowed on each of us from the outside to illustrate, in his words, that we are loved despite ourselves. Recognizing that others have this alien dignity offers us a different way of seeing the world, a different way of interacting with each other. Born of his experience and his witness in the Middle East, the Iraqi Archbishop Bashar Warda argued in our second event that if we lose the dignity of the human person, we're going to lose everything. These first two events of this series identified respect for our own dignity and for the dignity of others as a key enabler of hope in desperate contexts. Our speakers tonight are going to reflect on their understandings and experiences of dignity within the particularly challenging context of imprisonment. And I'm delighted to introduce Cara from the Ministry of Justice and Lord Hastings of Scarisbrick. Cara has over 15 years' experience leading prison and probation initiatives in the charity sector, with particular experience in prisoner rehabilitation and leadership. She is currently Senior Policy Advisor at His Majesty's Prison and Probation Service, where she shapes prison education policy with a focus on education and personal growth. Michael is an independent peer in the House of Lords. He's chair of SOAS and various other institutions. He was previously head of public affairs at the BBC, and he founded Crime Concern and Catch 22. He was the first black member of the Metropolitan Police Committee and served as Commissioner for Racial Equality from 1990 to 1999. You can read much more about both of our speakers in their extended biographies, which are on your seats, and we're incredibly grateful to them both for sharing their time and insights tonight. In terms of the format of our evening together, each speaker will begin by introducing themselves and share some reflections on dignity from their own perspectives and the experience of the criminal justice system. They will then have a conversation between themselves, but in front of us, we're very lucky, asking each other questions and discussing some of the issues in more detail. And so after around 40 to 45 minutes, I will rejoin them and invite you to ask further questions and continue the conversation. We'll finish promptly at 7:45. Thank you very much for being here this evening, essential components to this conversation. And please join me, firstly, in welcoming Cara.
Thank you. I'm just going to ask two questions really quickly first, by a show of hands. If you feel like at this point in time you have dignity, can you put your hand up? Can you keep your hand up if you feel like at any point in your life you lost dignity? Okay, thank you very much. So you just said loved despite ourselves, and I think that that's really, really important. So I'm going to talk for 7 minutes and try and, you know, put a few bits and pieces in there to let you know about my particular journey and my particular journey of dignity. I will give a bit of a trigger warning. I don't want it to necessarily offend or upset anybody in the room, but my story is and has been at different points difficult. And as a result, I've lost lots of dignity across the way, or never even had it in the first place. So when I heard you talking about me and introducing me and then hearing you talk about Michael and me being in that space, like in this beautiful place, wow, that's amazing. Because there was a point in time in my life where this would never have happened. So when I read my care file about a year ago, I saw in my care file that at 6 months old, I had been put into the care system, and I never knew that. And when I was 2 years old, I was taken and I was put in to live with my grandparents, and my mum and my dad just didn't want me. How that made me feel was, it made me feel as if I had no value, I wasn't loved, I wasn't wanted, and that there was no parent that was mine. And I remember my auntie used to sing my cousin David to sleep, and I remember thinking, oh, I wish I had a mum singing me to sleep. At the age of 5 till 11, my uncle sexually abused me. And I remember feeling like, at that very young age, I don't have any right to my body. I'm of no value to myself because I don't matter and I don't count. I'm there for somebody else's gratification. And I also went for many years being systematically unprotected by anybody. So at the age of 13, I decided that I was going to tell people. A sequence of events happened where I had overheard somebody else talk about themselves being abused, and I thought, it's not just me this has happened to. It's happened to lots of people. So I'm going to tell people because someone's going to believe me. They're going to wrap their arms around me and they're going to love me and protect me and they'll heal me and everything will be okay. And I disclosed and was told I was a liar. Nobody believed me. My dream was just shattered. And that made me feel very alone. And that made me feel even worse than being abused, because it made me feel like I really didn't matter at all to anybody. And I felt like my family and the people that should care for me had turned their back on me. They'd made a very obvious display that I didn't matter. So at 13, I went into the care system and I was offered a nice clean room. I was given the basics. I had clothes, I had food, but I wasn't chosen to be there as their special prized possession. It was a burden. And I was very aware of that. And that made me feel very alone. And I remember crying from deep inside my stomach and thinking, I just want someone to love me. I just want somebody to understand this pain, because this is horrible. And I want someone to give me a hug so that I feel like I'm worth something. And I didn't get that. I never got that hug. And so I had a really good idea that I would run away from the care system, and I felt really excited about that, and a little bit of my rebellious streak was in there, and I thought, oh, I can do what I want, I'll run off, I'll wear makeup and high heels and it'll be fun, I can go to parties, I can smoke a spliff of weed and drink a bottle of brandy, it'll be fine. But because of all the things that I already had, unfortunately running to the streets of London wasn't the best idea I had. And I ran into the hands of a horrible guy who was 10 years older than me and very much recognised quite quickly that I was a vulnerable young girl. And he beat the life out of me on a regular basis. He broke my nose. He cracked my ribs. He gave me black eyes. And I'd never been hit as a kid, so this was hard for me. And he slept with all my friends. He took me to places where things happened to me that shouldn't have. He coerced me to pick up men so that he could rob them and do terrible things to them. And I didn't want to do those things, but I had no choice. I had no choice. And I was scared of this guy because he was so powerful compared to me. and he gave me a 10% of affection that was worth, at the time, all of those punches, slaps and kicks. And that made me feel like I was nothing at all. So it's compounding everything else, and I'm starting to feel like I'm real rubbish and I don't have any dignity at all. So I felt like at that point, this world is absolutely evil and guys are evil and women are evil and the police are evil and everybody's just evil and I don't like this society at all. And so I made a very conscious decision that I was going to kick back at the system. And the very first time I went to prison, I went in and I remember that they gave me the cheapest of everything. Like, my husband's here and he sometimes buys custard creams and brings them home. I hate custard creams because the prison would give us them all the time. And also those horrible green blankets for anyone who's been in prison, like, ugh, and those horrible sheets and the thin mattresses. And the number, because I don't have a name anymore. I'm a number. And even though I've been sexually assaulted for years of my life and traumatised, they're still going to strip me off and ask me to do things so they can make sure I've not got anything on me. And that made me feel like nothing at all. And so then my rage came, and I know my 7 minutes are probably coming up, but my rage came and I made a very definitive and conscious decision to hate. Because I've got no dignity. So if I've got no dignity and I'm worth nothing, then I may as well hate. It's the easy option for me to do because nobody else wants me, nobody else cares. So I'm going to show everyone how angry I am because that's the only thing I can do is start to destroy. And that old kind of phrase of hurt people really rings out. And I did that for a very long time. So I will, during discussions with Michael, talk a little bit more about how, because I don't think I ever had dignity in the first place, but I'll talk about how my dignity was restored and what happened. I will talk a bit about working in the charity sector with people like Paula, and I will talk a little bit about my civil service job, although I haven't been given approval, so please nobody hold me to account. I'm not speaking on behalf of the civil service, although I work for them. I'm talking about my own experiences and what I think we can do to make a change. So I'm going to hand over to Michael in a second, but I just want to say before I do, you know, Michael is a very esteemed lord with many accolades, and I met Michael recently, and I said to my husband, I don't have many role models because I do not look up to titles at all, any title, but I do look up to Michael because of what Michael does and how Michael uses his privilege to be able to help people like us who haven't had opportunity. Michael loves people that have been broken. And, you know, Michael is an amazing man, so I'm going to hand over to Michael.
Well, I call her Lady Cara, always, and she will soon receive it in full. So let me begin with a short quote. Life's journey is not to arrive at the grave safely in a well-preserved body, but rather to skid in sideways, totally worn out, shouting, holy shit, what a ride. I really feel that because I believe that I've been given the privileges of position so that I may elevate others who are denied it. And that, for me, is the entire and only reason why titles and positions and privileges and opportunities are afforded to me. I want to give you just a statistic and ask you to reflect on it. In any average British year, the police right across the United Kingdom record around about 6.2 million offences. Most of those are relatively trivial. The more serious offences come out at around about 340,000. And the police, according to the Home Office, managed to accost, arrest, and bring to conviction 5.7% of that number. That has an interesting implication. It means that 94% of those who've committed a recordable crime, and even 94% of those in the 340,000, are all around us. Did that ever occur to you? There's probably some of you here. Hands up who hasn't admitted to their crimes. Well, they're on the bus, they're on the tube, they're in the office, they're in Parliament. Sometimes they're in number 10, but we know that. And I know, raw stuff, eh? The reason I give you that is very simple. As a country, we've spent decades despising people in prison. We think about them wrongly, we talk about them despicably, and we seek to make their lives harsher and more uncomfortable. It's become a national political habit. An election is coming, so guess what? Both sides toughen up. Longer sentences, more difficult to get people out. Those people deserve the hardest possible attack. A minister actually attacked me in Parliament last week, but in the House of Lords, everything's very gracious. Attacked me graciously in the House of Lords last week, reminding me that I had called the severe, savage sentencing strategy of this government unapproachably unethical. And the minister reminded me that it was those who committed the crime who are unapproachably unethical and not the sentence. He's wrong. He's wrong because we throw people away when we consider that they are less than of value to who we are. Strip them of their dignity, chuck them behind a door, and hope that somehow they rot away from our existence. So I was called in 1988 by the then Home Secretary Douglas Hurd. Now Lord, well, sadly passed away some years ago, but Lord Hurd. He was a dear friend. He became an even closer friend over the years when we worked together on alternatives to custody. He rang me in 1988 when I was but 26 or 7 years old, and he said, Michael, we need an alternative to imprisonment. We've got to find ways of keeping people out and not putting them away. We've got to find ways of giving men, and to some extent women, but the numbers are much smaller as we know, giving men dignity through the process on the assumption that innocence before guilt must remain a critical principle. So here we are in 2023, and there are 15,500 people in prison on remand, not convicted of any crime, but held in cells because the courts need to make a judgment based on some kind of proposition put to them by the prosecution that they may be guilty. 770 of those 15,000 are actually there over 2 years. So one of the men I got to know earlier this year is, I'll just call him D. He was in prison for 2 years and 2 months and finally released, no charges, no recompense, no apology, no resetting his life. Andrew Malkinson, who you all know about, 17 years held under falsified charges. He never committed the rape he was accused of. But society forms a fast judgment about people, whether they are educationally less than many would like to think, or in particular, if they come from a different ethnic class. Higher rates of incarceration, longer sentences imposed consistently, more difficult to get out. But dignity for those who are inside is respecting them as people not only worthy of love and treasure, but people who can give you equally back themselves. Wonderful men and women, but majority men, 84,000 men in prison, 4,000 women in prison. Men are the problem consistently, aren't they? I'm sorry about that, but that's the truth. The women can go, yes, we all know that, and it's the same at home. But men seem to commit more violent acts, and women seem to steal more things, seem to deal more drugs. Yes, men have a habit of getting in trouble. But like I told you at the beginning, the majority never get caught. So the mother of one of the men who, my son Kenny here, he was imprisoned for 6 months on falsified charges until a judge at the Old Bailey declared no case to answer. But 6 months gone, life could have been in tatters. But his story is contained in That Peckham Boy, published, of course, by Penguin. Top international publishers, came out earlier this year, so of course I'm promoting the book so you can go and buy it. And you can read the story of Kenny Amafordan's That Peckham Boy. But here, over there, Francois, wonderful woman, is the mother of someone that Kenny and I mentor in prison. She knows what I'm going to say, and she's perfectly at ease with it, and you know we know each other extremely well. Let me just call her son A. Her son is in prison for, and forgive me if I get, I think it's 22 years, isn't it? 20 years. And I think he's got five more to go. Five more to go. And when he does come out, I can't wait to have him at home. It will be so wonderful to have him at home. Kieran over there, stand up, Kieran. Show them your locks. Come on. Kieran came out after 13 years inside. On the 15th of September, came to my home on the 16th of September, but has frequently been here and around in Westminster. Dwayne, over here, came out earlier this year, came to my home in May, I think it was, here with his wife, Angelina. He did 20 years inside, 22 years inside, and 7 in isolation. These are great men. These are great men. They're full of life, full of love, full of dignity, full of purpose. So I'm going to read to you from a letter written by Francois' son, A, to Kenny and I, dated 3rd August 2022. It's important to give a bit of context. When we began our work in a prison in Kent 9 years ago, and we've now conducted 40 visits to that prison every 2 months, consistently through all of the 9 years, working closely with the governor and all of the staff team. We work now in 7 different prisons around the UK. We're just shortly adding another one, which we're delighted to do. We work in the youth estate, we work in the adult estate, and unlike other organisations of which we're not, we're just a family of brothers who love and care for one another. We don't charge, we never receive any money, and so there is no financial benefit to us whatsoever. But for me, this lifelong mission began in 1988, when Douglas Hurd said, find an alternative to the nasty incarceration mentality. When we met A for the first time, we were told that he was the single most dangerous man in the prison. So for me, that was an incentive to get to know him, because if he really was the single most dangerous man in the prison, I'm going straight over. And I went straight over and gave him a hug that day 9 years ago, and we built this bond of understanding. 5 years ago, he did some drastically dangerous things inside the prison. He got very drunk, he beat up some other prisoners, he damaged some cells. He was very angry about a number of issues. The governor rang me the next day and said, you know, what's normal in this situation is that we put him up into isolation, send them up north, and that's the end of them. But I don't want to do that. He's worthy of love and attention. He will change. Would you come in and spend some time with him? So I did. I went down, I cleared my diary the next day, spent some time with him on his own, got him to talk it all out, and we began what Kenny and I now do every Sunday at 7:30 in the morning. We speak with A. He rings on one phone, legally, he's allowed. Kenny rings on another phone, we put the two phones together, and we have a conversation. This is what he wrote to us in 2022. I find that we often forget the value and treasures found in good old-fashioned letter writing, lost due to the convenience of phone calls, emails, and visits. So I thought I'd write to you both a quick letter. I really just wanted to thank you both for all your continued love and support over the years, for it's difficult to describe the impact and the positive effect that you've both had on me. I will never forget the day we met and the powerful words that you shared with me. The open commitment you made to us on that day to be there for us was loving and sincere. Over the past 7 years, you've taught me so much about love, life, and the meaning of living. And just like Kenny, no matter what my past actions, you've never judged me, and that I am grateful for. We've experienced so many special moments together where you've often given me the floor to speak about my journey, the struggles and the transformation, the awards you presented me with. I have a picture of the three of us at the back of my diary and our first article that we anchored where we broke new ground and got the Director General of Prisons to agree to publish it. The truth is, this is so important here, the truth is I never had any men like you in my life who were sincere, loving and trusting, who were committed to me and who encouraged me and inspired me on so many levels. Your years of life and work experience feed my mind and my body with rich, powerful teaching that is truly priceless. I'm sure you'll both agree that my transformation has been incredible and will continue to be so. I owe so much of that to both of you, where I have had the pleasure of learning from the greats of society. You both, in your very own unique ways, have taught me how to receive and express love, which is so important. To be open and to be honest, to be patient, to be proactive, to take each step in life with integrity at the forefront of my mind. I do really hope that you can both see that in me. Most of all, you both have taught me how to hope and to hold on to hope for the future. And in some ways, I've become a prisoner of hope. I just love that. I'm absolutely hopeful and sure about my life, my character, and my future. I cherish and love our Sunday morning calls. I feel like I learned so much from the both of you. It is as if the calls have become food for my soul. You're both great men, powerful black leaders in your own right, and I trust that in the future, I'll become just as powerful and just as inspirational, so I can encourage and I can support others, just as you both do for me. Thank you so much. I love you both, your friend and your brother, A. True, isn't it, Francois? That's exactly how he is. When I hear a man like that and meet him and the hundreds of others that we work with consistently on a month-by-month basis, when we get the opportunity to unpick life around them, we see a different picture. So take Kieran over there. When he began his prison journey 13 years ago, he couldn't read and write. But now he has a published book on Amazon. You can buy it as well as buying Kenny's That Peckham Boy. You can buy his book on how to learn to play chess. Kieran Bryant, the pawn who became a queen. There you go. And he, not only has he a published book, but he has, in the last 6 years, read 260 non-fiction books.
Wow.
He taught himself to read, then became the best, most literate man you care to find on history, understanding, politics, and is doing a master's at the moment, Middlesex University on Business Administration. Not only that, whilst in prison, he created a business that now full-time employs 10 people, that's turning over close to £500,000, that registers nurseries across the UK and accredits them like Ofsted does a measurement system, all from inside prison. Anybody wants to tell me that you can't be an entrepreneur, a leader, literate, capable, competent, a role model, a man of significance, exactly how Dwayne is, exactly how Kenny is, exactly how Kieran is, anybody else who's here, who's been inside the system, that's how you can be. For here is another quote. Your entire life can really change in a year. You just have to love yourself enough to know you deserve more, be brave enough to demand more, be disciplined enough to actually work for more. But that love requires those of us in wider society to move away from the relentless judgment of those behind bars as if they are the failures. For the wider failure is in our wider social society where we condemn with such ease, criticize with such regularity, and distance ourselves with such perpetuity. We're more intentional about not loving than we ever are about loving. Thomas Merton, I'm sorry, a great Catholic, if that's all right in this environment, but we are on Catholic steps as well in here. He said, our job is to love others without stopping to inquire whether or not they are worthy. That is not our business. And in fact, it's nobody's business. What we're asked to do is to love. And this love itself will render both ourselves and our neighbors worthy, if anything can. We, Kenny and I and our team, we never ask any of the men we meet, what did you do? We just sometimes say, how long have you got? Because that way we can kind of understand what the journey ahead might look like. And then how can we support you in the journey you've got? Can we help you to fund education and learning? Can we communicate with you on a regular basis? Can we send you books? Can we network you to other people inside the prison, let alone to other prisons? And when you come out, guess what? You can have a safe place to come. There's a home over the road called the Palace of Westminster and the House of Lords, and I bring them all there. And you can come, and you can come to my home, and you can come to Kenny's home, you can come to our home, and you can meet people who will give you the assurance that your value, once taken from you. One of the things, I just say this is the last point. We began a program in Swellside Prison in Kent and copied it in a few others called Reverse Mentoring. It was a wonderful experience to watch prison officers having to be silent and hear the stories of prisoners. It was the first time many of them, officers, told us that they actually discovered something about the men that they pushed behind bars and slammed the door. Years and years had passed where they'd never had an encounter with a prisoner other than to shout and require them to step away. But reverse mentoring meant that the prisoner had the voice and the officer had the ear. One of the most fascinating experiences was two men sitting together, a prisoner and an officer. As the prisoner told his story, the officer cried. They lived on the same estate. They did the same teenage behaviors. They were in the same places. One got caught for his crimes. The other became an officer. The assumptions are too easy, aren't they? But the real dignity of people comes out at the point at which we inject the treasure of love to the hearts of those before us. Now, I'm not naive, and I'll finish with this. I know, and I've met some of them. I visited Boko Haram in Nigeria. I've met with the gangsters in South Africa. I've met some of the most hardened, determined criminals inside. There are people who never want to change. We know that. But one thing I can tell you, after nearly 40 years in this part of the business, that's not most of them. Most of them are people just like us. So, Cara, let me begin by asking you, wonderful lady that you are, what does it feel like now that you're formally in the system? You're in the Ministry of Justice, you're a civil servant, in a system that locked you away multiple times. It's not how do you feel about it, but how do you feel you want to change it?
So, I have to point out Paula Harriet, who works for the Prison Reform Trust, because Paula is somebody who's worked in criminal justice for a very long time and has led the way for people like myself to be in the space. In fact, Paula wrote the job description, co-wrote the job description for my first role in the civil service, which was the lived experience lead role. And do you know, I think when you recover yourself and you get dignity and you become loved, and what you just spoke about, people that are brilliant people that have, you know, overcome so much, learnt to read, learnt to write, and then become massive champions at those things. You know, we don't wish to, like I said, you know, we don't wish to cause harm anymore. We wish to be helpful because we have people that have believed in us. So, you know, like my husband has been pivotal to me feeling love and care. He was the first person to help repair all the damage that had been caused to me. You know, I thought I'd never be with a man again, but my husband is the best man that, you know, he was destined to just, you know, bring me back, to restore me to who I really should be. And I think working in the civil service, I feel privileged to be able to look at some of the gaps and look at some of the problems that you also spoke about, Michael, whereby you know, there are some attitudes that are not the best attitudes or the things that we would like to see. But those systems have been in place for such a long period of time. It takes a lot to undo things, to work through things, and to make policy changes that start to open people's eyes to the gems in the room that have been in prison, that go on to be those people that stop ongoing crime in society. You know, we are people just like everybody else. I never looked like this. Like, I had short hair, I wore baseball caps, bandanas, I swore every second word, I like wore trainers and like tracksuits. You'd have thought I was a boy, like, and I didn't smile ever. You know, but we are not that. And I get to be able to try and make a change. And when I go into prisons, sometimes I go back in the car park afterwards and I cry, because I see some people in prison still being treated like I was treated in the system 20 years ago. And that's not okay. And I know that all they'll create when they treat people like that is more of the rage and more of the anger. And the more we create rage and anger, the more victims there will be in society, because hurt people hurt people. You know, we need to love people. I've seen and met, you know, several of the people that Lord Michael is talking around and about, and they're brilliant people. You know, they are the absolute salt of society. But I think I have a bit of a question for you. Yes, shock horror. And I think for me, I really want to know. Like, I know you spoke about people that you'd met, but I personally, you know, do what I do because I've lived the life I've lived and had some things happen that make me really want to help others out of darkness. Like, is there anything personal that has made you feel like you really need to help people?
100%. I'm an intimate follower of Jesus, and I believe that his call on my life and all of us who want to follow him likewise is to do as he said, which is to provide freedom for those who are captives, liberty for those who are in prison, and the acceptance, the year of the Lord's acceptance. The writer to the Hebrews in chapter 13 in the New Testament says, identify with those who are in prison as though you were there yourself. And make the place of their hope your home. So you bring them close in. And not only that, but I'm hugely encouraged by Matthew 25, the words of Jesus, when he talks about the parallels between the sheep and the goats. The sheep being the acceptable in one way, the goats being the non-acceptable. And he says, you know, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me a drink. When I was homeless, you provided for me. When I was in prison, you visited me. And I've said to all of our men in our network, and Kenny's a key leader in that, and we have a duty to do the things Jesus told us to do. So, first of all, for me, it comes from this is my faith, this is my duty. I don't have an option. I cannot squirm out of it. I've got all these other things I have to do, all these places I've got to be, but I cannot turn my back on people who are in hospital, people who are homeless, people who are in prison. I cannot do that. I can't ignore their enormous reality, because that must be part of my reality. So that is a key driver for me. And then when I was asked to create Crime Concern in 1988, and we started on the journey of changing the minds. I mean, Douglas Eyre, who was Margaret Thatcher's Home Secretary, and you'd think that he'd be, you know, harder than Suella Braverman. Impossible. I think this floor is softer. But never mind. Sorry, but anyway, she's not here. Are you here, Suella? We have a cell for you waiting. You know, Douglas Hurd, when we had our private chats, and I was just a, you know, black kid in my later 20s, and what he was saying to me is, we have to create a culture that understands that people are not improved by denigrating them and destroying their soul. They're improved by giving them hope and treasuring the beauty within them and pulling out of them the best of their possibilities. So I've been motivated by that for 40 years, and my faith has motivated me for 52 years. So, you know, I will continue. Kenny and I make it. We set our dates for prison visits frequently. So Reese, who's just worked in, he focuses on Cook and Wood Prison and ISIS Prison, which are both essentially younger offenders prisons, although sometime too at the Mount. And then Kenny and I focus on the other bigger prisons. And, you know, we've been on this journey of consistently making sure that I remember one of the things Kenny said to me, because, as I said, he suffered 6 months inside on falsified charges, complete lies from the prosecution. And thank goodness for a judge who could see through it so quickly, is that, you know, Home Office figure. Let me give you a key Home Office figure. For anybody serving a sentence in the UK for longer than, I think it's 3 years, 3 or 4 years, so that's, you know, about half, only 9% ever get a visit. That means 95% of people in prison are thrown away. People slam the door. Families disappear. Friends are no more. And I remember Kenny saying to me on one occasion, you know, what's amazing, because we would go every 2 months, and we still do. So we're there on the 20th of September. The day after, on the 21st, I'm visiting someone else in a prison up north. Reese and I are doing, well, he's doing football, I can't do it. But we're in an ISIS prison between Christmas and New Year doing a football game. I mean, we program this in because we both said to each other, we have to be consistent. Because if we're the only consistent people they ever meet, because no one else comes. So we must be, if we say we're going to come, we better go. And we can't make excuses. And we can't say, I don't feel well. And I've got something else to do. Nothing gets in the way. You know, I have been, I don't mind saying it, I have been asked to attend all sorts of powerful places when we have prison visits in the diary. And I just say, no, I'm actually meeting the people that Jesus wants to see first.
I love that.
So tell, Cara, I want you to tell us, after you, because you did 16 times.
Yes.
Inside. Did you hear that? 16, so she knows exactly where the keys are.
It's the sign of somebody that wasn't very good at crime.
So after you finally had done with it all, how long did it take you to feel good about yourself?
My poor husband, I don't know how he's still with me. A very long time. I think I had so many behavioural problems, and I had so many... I'd lived on the streets, right? So I didn't really know normal behaviour. I lived with people that would just bang you over the heads with, like, a mallet, or would take out a knife and stab you, or put you in the boot of a car. Like, I lived with people that never talked to the police, and I didn't live in a house. Like, I lived wherever I fell asleep. You know, I never paid bills, I never worked a job, I didn't do any of those things. So all the normal behaviours that you'd expect to have built didn't exist, and I had been let down by everyone I'd ever met. I'd been, like I just said, I'd been, you know, let down by the people that was there supposedly to care and love me, and that didn't happen. So my trust was just decimated. And so, you know, like, I think, my God, you know, the first five, maybe my husband and I have been together 20 years, life sentence, and
she doesn't look old enough, does she?
And first 5 or 10 years, like, I would say crazy things to my husband, and, like, I was constantly trying to push him away from me, because if he went, then that would demonstrate to me that, you know, like, I was those crazy things, or I wasn't worth staying for. And so that was one part of a barometer of how I tested whether or not I was getting better. I also had a lot of mental health support in the community, by one particular psychiatric nurse, I think she was, and a lady called Rosie Alvarez. And I couldn't make appointments. Like, I didn't even sign on the dole. Like, I had no ability to do anything and stay and come back and be on time. And so she would say, like, because I'd always been a crisis, I think I spent 3 years in a crisis, and she would say, I don't care what time she comes in, make her a cup of tea, and I will see her when I finish with the person. She went above and beyond to try to help me. And then the other thing was I went into some services because I definitely didn't know how to communicate at work with people. And I just didn't know any of the rules. And I had to volunteer to begin with. And I also left school at 13. Mm. So I had no I did go to private school when I was in Ireland, but I had no GCSEs. I think I started school when I was 7 or 8 and I left when I was 13. And so I wasn't educated either. So I had to do a lot. I had to learn how to be educated. I'm on my third degree now.
More than me.
Woohoo! And I also had to learn how to not walk down the road and hit somebody because I didn't know how to not lash out. And I had to learn, the hardest thing was not using drugs, because drugs for me were a safe space where I could be high and I didn't have to take accountability. I didn't have to feel a feeling, because feelings for me were really difficult, you know. And I guess that's a long answer. The short answer would be, I'm still not 100% now. I came out of prison 20 years ago, and I will still create scenarios in my head and go, you know, this is going to happen, or like my colleague at work said that, but they really mean this. And then I'll go to send an email, and thank God for recall an email on Outlook. God. I guess a few of you that laughed have done that too.
Yes. Well, I don't know how to do it. You need to show me.
I'll teach you. But I think also as well, just really quickly, if we've got time for one more. The other thing I wanted to ask you was what you said just there about inviting people into your home. Now, I know why you do that, right? And I would probably do that too. Although my husband might say you're not allowed. No, he'd be all right. We're a bit antisocial, both of us. But I think, you know, inviting people into your home, do you ever feel like you get stigmatised by other people, like in the House of Lords or in the House of Commons or in other realms where you are, because of your inclusivity of people like us?
Well, if I am, I'm not aware of it. I mean, people probably talk behind my back all the time. And that's absolutely fine. And I don't mind. You know, I believe that irrespective of what members of the House of Lords may feel, I mean, I did have a minister some years, a Home Office minister, who came up to me one day and she said, oh, I was at a conference, speaking at a conference yesterday on reform and renewal, and one of your guys was speaking. I said, oh, really? Which one? Was it Noel? And she said, yes, it was Noel. I said, how did you know he was one of my... Oh, just the way he spoke. I knew he was one of yours. And so I realised that actually they're watching me, in the sense that, you know, they know that I bring the men in when they come out of prison. They know that I host events in the palace of people who've been, you know, people who've never been anywhere near a prison and people who have been in prison. But I do that because these are people I've chosen to trust. And if you make the decision not to trust people, you know, you feel the distance grow. And you feel that you make decisions and attitudes harden. And for me, I feel a strong passion to be a person of justice and to treat them as equal, absolutely equal, to give them dignity and to respect their humanity and to realize, you know, and here we are in Westminster Abbey, which is phenomenal. It's overwhelming, isn't it? Really phenomenal. And I always remind people that as Jesus was dying on the cross, he took the hand of the prisoner next to him, come with me into the kingdom. It wasn't a person with a title. It was a person from a cell. I love that.
I'm extremely reluctant to interrupt this conversation, and thank you both for being so extraordinarily open, honest, generous. I'm keen to extend the circle of conversation, though. We've got a lot of people involved in public policy here, and just to get the extended conversation going, I wonder whether you both might just say very briefly, if you could say one thing to policymakers, one thing, what would it be?
Ladies first.
Mine would be, you need to place the value of people's lived experience in your workspace the same way you do policymakers. They need to be threaded through all the work and given good roles in order to be able to do that and good training to be able to do that.
Thank you, Michael.
I would show them, well, I did do it in a speech in the House of Lords 2 weeks ago, I would show them how to reduce the prison population by half virtually overnight. And, you know, we have 2,998 men held under IPP provisions in prison, which is no longer a legal sentence. Let them out.
Yeah.
We have half the women in prison who are there for the pettiest of crimes. Let them out. It is absolutely ridiculous. We have, as I said, 778 men on over 2 years on remand. Let them out. Treat them as though they are innocent until proven guilty. This is crazy. We have a system built on locking people up when we should be trusting that we can understand the nature of what they may or may not have done and treat them as fellow citizens until we can discover what we might call a crime. It is vital that we stop. Here we are with a government now saying, we want to build more prisons. And not only do we want to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, good luck, but we want to send our surplus prisoners to Northern Europe where they've got empty prison spaces. Why have they got empty prison spaces? Because they treat people who commit crime differently and they close the prisons down. Why don't we just learn from those who do it well?
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a long answer, but I'm so with the system.
It's a wonderful answer. I mean, the throwaway culture that we talk about in the West now is not just the throwaway culture in terms of stuff, it's people too, isn't it, too often?
Totally.
Friends, I'm going to open the conversation now. I think somebody, Catherine, I think has a microphone. There's a lady here and then Peter at the back.
Thank you both very much.
If you could say your name and where you're
Jennifer
from.
Ball. I did 10 years as a lay visitor monitoring conditions for detainees in police stations after Skullman. And then I did 10 years as a lay observer monitoring conditions for prisoners in transit at court. And one of the depressing things is that your discussions with Douglas Hurd haven't produced more fruit in the last 40 years. But something I wanted to ask, because you alluded, but without referring directly to it, is to change public opinion and the idea that there are no votes unless you say in the increasingly populist politics, lock them up, don't see them again, clean the streets, and, you know, 94% are going to still be there, but the voters don't know that. What is your view on restorative justice? Because the work I did years ago was tangentially linked with Kulisa from South Africa, who work on making sure people don't go to prison in the first place. Would you see that as a way of changing public opinion? What's your view?
Ladies first.
I think restorative justice is very valuable. I didn't talk about it there, but I did do restorative justice at one point and it did change my criminal behaviour. I think that there's a lot of spaces where we can use restorative justice to build bridges. I think instead of just locking people up and creating the rage, we're actually getting both parties to understand each other. And when you understand what you've done to somebody else and you see them as a human rather than a transaction or an issue or an instance, I think that helps people to modify their own behaviour in a different way and have a connection with the community. The problem is that people don't currently have connection with the community, and that would help to do that, I think.
I 100% believe in restorative justice. We need to see it effectively practiced in our system. People who have committed dangerous, life-removing, serious and damaging crimes, to a large extent, most did not intend to do it. And the evidence backs that up solidly. Very few organize a killing or a stabbing, but rage in a moment. Rage of events, rage because of alcohol or drugs, rage because of experiences, causes people to do rash, reactive things for which they deeply regret. And this is one of the mad issues of the government's attitude about sentencing. They say, well, if we make the sentences tougher, it'll stop. No, it doesn't. America is the exact example of longer permanent sentences with the most savage criminal culture you can possibly find. It doesn't, because in the moment people do dumb stuff. But when they come to, oh, do they regret it. And to get the opportunity to admit that error, it doesn't mean to say they get any less time inside, but it just means to say that their hearts get cleaned of their guilt and they can begin to restore their own dignity.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bishop Peter Selby.
I was president of the Independent Monitoring Board for a few years and bishop to prisons for a few more, and I've been involved less effectively and even longer than Lord Hastings. And I've reached a difficult point about all of this, and it's the point where I find an analogy which I find very disturbing. We know from the history of slavery that there were kind, good, dedicated people who tried to make it better. And we know that we have concluded, mercifully, that you can't actually make it a place of dignity, that is just the indignity is fundamental to the system. And I've reached the point of wondering whether my great-grandchildren will look back in amazement that we thought that depriving people of their liberty was an appropriate thing to do for people who'd done things we could not condone or allow. And I've been privileged to meet all sorts of people, some like yourselves, in other all sorts of places, trying to make it better and trying to be as humane as the inspiring vision you've both expressed. But I actually wonder whether we don't have to conclude that this whole idea is fundamentally undignified and fundamentally has to be, it's not just that we need some alternatives to custody, we just need to clear our minds of the idea that this ever could be right.
Wow. Responses from our speakers.
Well, you said it, and it's true, what you said. The battle I've gone through in my mind is, irrespective of Douglas Hurd's commission, irrespective of 21 years as chairman of Crime Concern and now 20 years with Catch-22, despite all of the stuff that I now do, should I focus my energy on trying to get policy change, or should I focus my energy on meeting people inside and helping them walk to the outside? And I've concluded that I'd rather do the latter, because society is stuck. And the only way we're really ultimately going to change it is a political leadership that recognizes that in this area, we are failing. People who run systems of criminal concern in the Netherlands, in Germany, in the Balkan countries, and believe it or not, even in Brazil, are doing better than we are doing, really much better than we are doing. And they are reducing prison sizes and helping people to have new renewal from what could be serious lives. But we just have a political culture that is stuck in punishment and persecution. And until we grow up in exactly the way you've said, it won't change. But that's why I'm adamant at supporting the individuals and the groups that we work with. You know, we had one of the prisons I said that Rhys and I spent a lot of our time in, Cookham Wood, which is a youth offender prison. And recently, after we played, he played as captain of our team there, and Kenny's captain of our team in the other prisons. After they played a game, and I observed, and we were then handing out awards to these are up to 18-year-olds. And so we give them prizes, we recognize the best players, those who've made progress since the last time, et cetera, et cetera. And one particular prison officer, a large black gentleman, came over to me. He was an officer in the prison. He said, "Could I have a word with you in the corner?" I thought he was going to criticize us. I went over to the corner with him. He said, "Tell me something. How come these boys here, these young men, pay attention to everything you say? How come they sit and listen to the stuff you tell them? How come they behave so well here? How come they seem so keen and they ready themselves for these days?" He said, "How come you can do that and we can't?" And I said, "It's very simple. We love them and you don't. If you just love them, they would actually eat out of your hand. Because the absence of love for so many is the reason why they've got into the rotten place they're in. So we can solve it, but we just have to change our attitude."
Thank you, Cara.
I might have a slightly different view, might not always be welcomed, but I do think we need to reduce prisons, and I do think that a lot of prisons are not dignified, and the way we treat people is not dignified. But I also think that there are victims at the end of things too. And I do think that I know sometimes that the times that I went to prison, it may have been, the way I was treated there was not appropriate or dignified, but sometimes, that sentence was deserved. I probably needed to be in that space. So I do think that there is a time and a place where that might be appropriate. But I do agree with you, Michael, in the sense that I think that there's a lot we can do. So, for example, I've worked on some projects recently where we have had people with lived experience going in and speaking to people and speaking to officers and helping them to understand what it feels like for people, so that there's a bit of a connection instead of an us versus them. And I have seen some work and pockets of work, and you talk about Swaleside, and we know the governor of Swaleside is a great governor trying to make a difference. And you look at the governor of Elmley, the same thing. There are some great people that are trying to create the most dignified space as possible, but I think that we're not putting enough resource into these spaces. For if you've got if you don't have enough staffing capacity, how can you really give people time and love? How can you care about that person when you open the door and listen to their experience when they're saying, I've had a difficult situation and I need to address that? We went to a prison recently, and the guy was a VP prisoner, and he was saying that he had done some sex offences to an adult, and they were stopping him seeing his children. But that actually, it was a case of he was going to kick off in one way or another in a couple of weeks because he wanted to see his kids, and there were no bars on him or restrictions on him from seeing his kids. But because of the lack of resource, no one was giving him time and explaining anything to him. And so we need to... I do have some hope. I know I probably sound like an idiot, but I do have some hope that there are people, Kenny, you, Reese, Paula, others in this room, that with love and care, behind the scenes or on the operational line, can somehow make a difference to people. Mm. I have to keep that hope alive.
And I just wanted to add that as part of Crime Concern, we created victim support. And I was proud that we launched it, and I'm proud to support it now.
Wonderful. I can see more hands. Lady in the front here, followed by the gentleman here. And if we could take two questions at a time, that would be great. Thank you very much.
I'm Paula. I've been getting quite a bit of a shout out, but thank you, Cara. But I think my observation here is that somebody asked about what can we do to change things. And I think from my perspective, it's as a former prisoner myself, it's that we can't wait for something to happen. We have to be the people who make the change happen. So I salute the work that you do on individual levels to support people through understanding the power of the metaphysical. And I think that's really important. I think there's a deficit of moral leadership in this conversation. It's really sad, and I'd say that everybody who's here today should be and exert their own power in moral leadership around this conundrum about what justice really means for us. And I suppose in my world, what I build is the capacity to understand the depth of the individuals who've been to prison, the depth of isolation, and how that unlocks a deep-seated wisdom and sensitivity to injustice. And I don't think we should forget that. And we should welcome and activate that within people, build their capacity for leadership. Because the more visible people are who have been through this process, the more we have the ability to speak, to articulate, to marshal compelling arguments about what justice means in this country. I think it's that building that collective of people who've unleashed that insight, people who combine with others, who feel the sole purpose to work with us in that space. I think that's where you movements of change happen. They happen through commitment. They happen through spiritual insight. They happen through dedication, persistence, and collective endeavour. And that would be my answer to the question. I'd ask the panel to reflect on that.
Thank you very much. And just before they do, the gentleman on the end here. Thank you.
My noble lord, as a student of the laws of England of Wales, of the laws of England and Wales at Oxford, I was always excited when I was told that this book is published by Penguin, because I knew it would be affordable. The first book that you mentioned this evening was also published by Penguin. Unfortunately, I didn't get the title.
That Peckham boy, and there he is over there. Yeah, that's the physical Peckham boy.
Peckham boy. Fantastic. Let's take one more whilst we're up. Just here, please, gentleman in the middle. And then I'm going to ask our panel to respond.
Hello, my name's Mike Ribeiro. I'm chairman of Spurgeons, which is a children's charity, and we do some prison work in HMP prison, Winchester Estate, and also Feltham Young Offenders. And I'd just like you to think about, also all of us to think about some of the people that are forgotten and their dignity is stolen from them when their fathers, and it's mainly fathers that are imprisoned, it's the children and the partners who are left behind. And the dehumanising effect of seeing a four-year-old girl having to go through the security checks, the big Alsatian dogs sniffing them down, going through all those locks just to get into a play centre or a family centre, which is poorly underfunded, so they can spend some time with their father. And one of the things that we do with the families that we look after is to make sure that we're looking after those that are left behind, but also trying to work with those that are inside to help them be better parents. And even if it's just a small thing as to record digitally a good night story for their son or daughter, it's so empowering and so dignifying for both the father and the mother and also for the child.
Thank you very much. Could I ask our speakers to reflect on any of that? Should we start, Carol, with you?
I almost wanted to give a round of applause to Paula because, you know, like what you said is just, you know, exactly as it should be. And I think there is the moral position. I think it's so hard sometimes too, in competing spaces, trying to navigate which way you can do that. Because sometimes we spoke the other day about deliberately being shut down, particularly when we're trying to drive that voice forward and that moral position. And I think, you know, I had to be reminded again by another person with lived experience, I'm a civil servant, but you're not a civil servant. You are a person with lived experience. Don't forget that. Don't become like a civil servant. No offense to any civil servants in the room, but I have to retain that moral position of who I am. And sometimes I have to choose my battles wisely, and I will do that with more kind of rigor and determination. And then in other spaces, I'll think, it's not the right moment for this, but there's a space and I'm trying to strategically look for where I can do that. But I think we need more people like you reminding us to do that. That's really important. And then just quickly before I go to Michael, you know, I also wanted to say to yourself, like, that made me feel really warm and fuzzy because, you know, making a story for your child and that child feeling that, But we also know that not many people have family contacts when they're in prison. You know, Michael, you talked about people not getting visits. But for those that do, the victims of people that are in prison, I don't know the lady's name, but the son, A, or when Michael's talking about you, and I was thinking of my sons, I've got two sons, and I can't imagine what it would be like if my younger son was to be taken away from me for 20 years. Like, I can't imagine the strength and resilience you've needed to be able to sustain that. But I do think that projects like your own can make those small little moments of light in such darkness, but we need to keep doing more.
Rather than me say more, because what you both said was beautiful, I'm going to get Kenny to turn his brain on now and get him to reflect on this a little bit as somebody with vivid lived experience, but also the author of That Peckham Boy, and a passionate prison visitor with two friends who are doing very long sentences. And he takes the daughter of one of those friends out on a regular basis. So he's the alternative family. But could we just bring the microphone up here so he can say a few things? Because I always love listening to Kenny, so why don't you listen to Kenny? Go on, stand up, beloved.
Should you stand up?
Yeah, go on, so they can see you.
Jim, I was planning to enjoy it like a normal guest. But I'm Kenny, That Peckham Boy. Hey everyone. But yeah, God, what was it? You know, I found today's discussion definitely, it's had the right balance. And I feel in terms of what Paul was talking about before, just the importance of moral leadership. I'll probably go this way so everyone can see me. And I would just say one thing to add to that is also just the importance of courage.
Yeah.
Right? It's one word which has been robbed from a lot of our vocabulary when talking about leadership and the importance of it. And the reason why I think a lot of things don't change is because a lot of leaders and people that have influence lack courage.
Yeah.
And courage to do things in spite of public perception. Because public perception will tell you, as it does as the research, some research done recently shows that 75% of people actually, when asked whether sentences have got longer, stayed the same or shorter, 75% of them say that they feel that it's been shorter. Those sentences have increased over the last two decades easily. So it shows when we're talking about public perception, people don't really understand the reality and are very far removed. But then also, I think coming back to the point which Lord Hastings made earlier about how much people who commit crimes are not found guilty, that are around people anyway. Even those who are in prison, people need to remember that 99% of them will come out one day.
Yes.
And that number shouldn't go, but people said 99%. And when we think about the cost of keeping people in prison and the cost of reoffending as well, because that's another thing which I haven't discussed today, that cost is probably about 18 billion. And when you think about that number, it sounds crazy when you look at the social and economic costs. But then when you then think about the government spends the same on housing and community development. And so you can imagine when you're looking at the wastage of what happens when we don't do what we need to do and where that money could be invested. And the fact that people can be worth more in prison at the cost of £50,000 a year to be inside, and they would never get that investment on the outside.
Yeah.
And doesn't that make people think? And if you're in some young offenders, you could be even worth £150,000, £200,000 a year. However, those people, they would, the cost to even give them someone who could look after them full-time, a carer, mental therapy, they will never get it. Right. But if you're in prison, the country will happily invest £150,000 in you, and doesn't really matter if you reoffend because they just keep doing it. So again, I think we definitely have to rethink how we see prison and how it works in general. But I think more importantly, for people like myself and my own journey, I feel that one thing that it does show is that actually, and one of the reasons why I really have loved the book and putting it out there is that the perception people have of people who go to prison and their trajectory after is extremely limiting. Because a lot of time when you're in prison, all people really want you to do, even when they support you, is to become legitimate. Now you have to imagine, I'm someone who grew up in a single parent household. Me and my little brother, I left school with 12 GCSEs, 5 that I got. By the end of year 10, I was flying, I was a prefect in school. But at the same time, I was still selling weed and making money. Now, until I said that, up until then, you probably thought this kid was doing brilliant. Because I probably did better than some of your kids in school. That's fine, don't worry, it's all right, it's okay. But also, and the reason why I share that is because it throws crap at the face of what people believe.
Mm.
Okay, I was well educated, I knew stuff, I was gifted and talented. And yet I still found a way to hustle. My mum done everything, showed me all the love, all the dignity, everything. However, I still made different choices.
Oh.
And 2 days after turning 18, I found myself arrested for murder and 6 other charges, alongside 5 other of my friends. For a murder that I've not committed, and then all of a sudden I'm getting ready to go and study philosophy, politics, and economics, and then instead I found myself in Felton prison. And so you have to imagine, as Mike talked about earlier, so even just going through that journey and going to prison, and I talk about, when you talk about dignity earlier, about I'd never been strip searched until I got there. And it's something which I don't hope for anybody. But that's something that I had to do when I went in, and when I was going to court at the Old Bailey every day, in and out. And some days you come back, you don't even get to shower, because you come back too late.
Yeah.
So again, I think, the reason I'm sharing this story is because even though through that moment of indignity, I still was able to do my A-levels in prison. Mm. I still passed my A-levels, first person to ever do them in Felton prison. Mm. And at the time, again, the reason why it was such a big thing to do is because people didn't even factor in that there may be someone here who wants to do A-levels.
Mm.
And it shows you already how much the prison system even sees the people that are there. And so it's even to come out of all of that and thank God be acquitted and build my life. It wasn't building a life of just, can I be legitimate? It was, how could I live out my dream? And again, showing people that you don't have to make particular choices, and you can make different ones, you can still be successful, you can still create a company that makes millions and do all this other stuff there, and do it legitimately, still get a degree and still do it. But again, it's so important that people like myself share that story, because once you've heard it, it has to change how you think about people that have now been through that. Because at the end of the day, is when you think about the people that are in prison or the people that commit crime or whatever, my real question is, what do they look like?
Hmm.
And if you have a picture, then that is very scary, because they look like all of us.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kenny.
Friends, with great reluctance, I have to draw this conversation to a close. We've heard such openness, integrity, authenticity tonight from our two principal speakers, but also from other friends and guests who are with us in the chapel. And I want to thank each and every one of them on my own behalf, chairing this evening, but on behalf of the Abbey Institute and on behalf of Westminster Abbey, on behalf of all of us for being here this evening, for helping us to see how love might be a political philosophy, how love might actually cash out, a sense that actually we can't throw anybody away, and that our systems collude in throwing people away, and that actually ensuring that people know that they're loved is right at the heart, not only of our, as it were, personal lives, but of our public life. And if we had public ways of indicating that love more fully, we might just be able to change our culture a bit. So finally, just to renew our thanks to Cara and Michael for this evening, and to you all for being with us. Thank you very much indeed.